ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Canto 5. Chapter 14. Text 29. 30? Okay, sorry. Yes, it's 30. Thank you. Translation. The pseudo-svamis, yogis, and incarnations who do not believe in the Supreme Personality of Godhead are known as Pashandis. They themselves are fallen and cheated because they do not know the real path of spiritual advancement. And whoever goes to them is certainly cheated in his turn. Are you sure that this is 30? No, it's 29, because that's the verse that I prepared for. So we'll start again. The personal weapon used by Lord Krishna, the disc, is called Hari Chakra, the disc of Hari. The chakra is the wheel of time. It expands from the beginning of the atoms up to the time of Brahma's death, and it controls all activities. It is always revolving and spending the lives of the living entities from Lord Brahma down to an insignificant blade of grass. Thus one changes from infancy to childhood to youth and maturity, and thus one approaches the end of life. It is impossible to check this wheel of time. This wheel is very exacting, because it is the personal weapon of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sometimes the conditioned soul, fearing the approach of death, wants to worship someone who can save him from imminent danger. Yet he does not care for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose weapon is the indefatigable time factor. The conditioned soul instead takes shelter of a man-made god described in unauthorized scriptures. Such goals are like buzzards, vultures, herons, and crows. Vedic scriptures do not refer to them. Imminent death is like the attack of a lion. And neither vultures, buzzards, crows, nor herons can save one from such an attack. One who takes shelter of unauthorized man-made gods cannot be saved from the clutches of death. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. It is stated, Harim vina mritam na taranti. No one can save himself from the cruel hands of death without being favored by Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In Bhagavad Gita, it is stated, Mam eva ye prabhadyante mayametam tarantite. Whoever fully surrenders unto Krishna can be saved from the cruel hands of material nature. The conditioned soul, however, sometimes wants to take shelter of a demigod, man-made god, pseudo-incarnation or bogus swami or yogi. All these cheaters claim to follow religious principles, and all this has become very popular in this age of Kali. There are many Pashandis who, without referring to the Shastras, pose themselves as incarnations, and foolish people follow them. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, has left behind him Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. Not referring to these authorized scriptures, rascals take shelter of man-made scriptures and try to compete with Lord Krishna. That is the greatest difficulty one encounters when trying to promote spiritual consciousness in human society. The Krishna consciousness movement is trying its best to bring people back to Krishna consciousness in its pure form. But the Pashandis and atheists, who are cheaters, are so numerous that sometimes we become perplexed and wonder how to push this movement forward. In any case, we cannot accept the unauthorized ways of so-called incarnations, gods, cheaters, and bluffers. By unauthorized, Srila Prabhupada means people who do not refer to the authorized scriptures or the revealed scriptures or the words of God and His great servants. They rather consider themselves a god unto themselves and consider that everything that comes out of their head is necessarily the divine word. So this is what Srila Prabhupada is calling. That's why he refers to them as bluffers and cheaters. And very often people do not know. And we'll get into this in a few moments. And they are described here as crows, vultures, buzzards, and herons. Omagina timirandasya gananjana shalakaya chakshur unmilitam yena tasmai shri guruve namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto his lotus feet. I pray for the mercy and the blessings of all the assembled Vaishnavas and all the Vaishnavas who may be listening on the internet. I pray for your blessings that I may be able to say something useful and beneficial for all of you, and for myself as well, so that we may all grow even taller in Krishna consciousness today than we were before. By the mercy of the Vaishnavas, by the mercy of Krishna, this can happen. So herein, just 1 second, please. This is called the Forest of Enjoyment. That's the title of this. So Shukdev Goswami is speaking, and he's giving us some very important factors or points on spiritual living. And he's telling us in no uncertain words that time is forever present. Time is forever consuming everything in its path. And those who are Krishna conscious can see this happening all around them. And those who are not Krishna conscious, which is the vast majority of human beings, do not see it, and consequently go on in the deluded consciousness that they are going to go on in their physical bodies on and on and on forevermore, even though people are dying all around. Often when people die, those who are so deluded become somewhat surprised, stunned, shocked. How could this happen? Because they were thinking that everything is going to go on forever. It will never stop. And why do they think that? Well, you go out into the street, you see this, we go out, we see the same trees every day. They're still standing there. They've been there for the last 35 years that I've been here. The sidewalk is here. The street is here. The stores are here. The grass is here. All the things that we saw yesterday and the day before and the day before, they're still here. So, if everything is going on, then I'm going to go on. So, why should I worry? Why should I think? Why should I consider? I'll simply go on trying to enjoy my life, having as much pleasure as I possibly can. So this is the foolishness, this is the delusion of the average or ordinary human being. He acts as if he were going to go on forever. When I say he, I mean that which he is fully identifying himself with, his body. He thinks his body is going to go on, and yet when someone dies, he's shocked, surprised, he's stunned, he's amazed, he's awed, he wonders, why? How come? Why should this be a surprise? As I speak now, probably 100 people have just died. But because we stay in that illusion, the illusion that everything will go on because I see it going on. I saw clouds in the sky yesterday. I see clouds in the sky today. I saw a blue sky yesterday. There's a blue sky today. I saw my body yesterday. I see it today. It's forever. It's going to go on. And therefore, they're surprised. Surprised because they were anticipating something that could never be. This is what made them so completely disturbed. A devotee sees things differently. When he sees the tree, he doesn't only see the tree. He looks under the tree and on the sidewalk and sees that there are leaves lying on the sidewalk. Not green leaves, but brown leaves. Not straight leaves, but crinkled leaves. Dried leaves, withered leaves. And he knows, and in his mind, he says, that will be my body one day. That is the reality. And he knows this reality as to be his own body. He looks at the sidewalk. He sees cracks in the sidewalk. So it's not the same as it was a year ago. A year ago, there weren't any cracks. He looks in the street and he sees holes in the street that weren't there a year ago. He sees that everything is in a state of flux, in a state of change. Everything is moving. Nothing stops. As it's mentioned here, the wheel of time is forever active. The person in the material world who is a non-devotee, he fears death because it signifies to him the end of all the things that gave meaning and value and purpose to his life. His body gave purpose to his life because he could have so much sense pleasure with it. His mind gave purpose to his life so that he can make so many plans for sense pleasure. His intelligence gave life, meaning to his life because it enabled him to think out and solve problems to enable his sense gratification to go on. And then his properties, his car, his home, his wife, his children, his relatives, his business associates, his business, all these are the acquirements and the accumulations of what he has achieved in his life. And at death, they're all going to be reduced into a big resounding zero. Nothing. Emptiness. It's scary. You've been working year after year, day after day, and now you have everything. It's all there. And then suddenly you get a stroke, or suddenly you have a heart attack, or you have a brain attack, or you have some type of an attack. And you realize death can come in any second. And it's so scary because this big false ego, you know, like a big blimp, every time we acquire something, you get some praise, you get some adoration, get some profit, get some glorification, get a new trinket, get a new toy, get a boat, get a car, get a plane, get another child. All of these are the accumulations of the false ego. This is mine. I own this. I have acquired this by my effort, by my doing. Therefore, I'm wonderful. And then to see that all of it is about to come to an end, a big zero, a nothing. Well, what have I been working for? What have I been doing all this for? So these are the trappings of the false ego. As I refer to it often, like a big blimp that gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And at the time of death, it just collapses. You all seen that blimp over the various arenas and stadiums, the Goodyear blimp. It's misnamed. It should be the Bad Year blimp. Because all it gives you is bad years. You get pleasure, you get joy, you get satisfaction from your senses, and then what? Misery, uncertainty, doubt, anxiety. This is the difficulty of living for the false ego. So, therefore, it is recommended strongly that a devotee gives up this consciousness of trying to acquire, to accumulate the bad year blimp, and instead get the real good year blimp. The real good year blimp is the reduction, the suppression, the contraction of the false ego. In other words, in a sense, no blimp. No false ego. When there is no false ego, then one is completely free of all of the miseries, the anxieties, the uncertainties, and the doubts. How can we be free of false ego, though? If the desire of every living entity who comes into this world is to lord it over the material world, to become a controller, an enjoyer, a proprietor, a friend of all, and a sense gratifier. Actually, this is what God does. God is always enjoying. He owns everything. And everyone, and he's the friend of everyone. So we come to this world for no other or better purpose than to, as Prabhupada nicely puts it, to imitate him. Imitating him means to forget him, ignore him, neglect him, take the spotlight away from him and put it on ourselves. We see every famous either movie star, sports star, music star, political star, when they receive some triumph or receive some award, they say, I want to thank my mother and I want to thank my father and I want to thank all the people who assisted me and helped me. But God doesn't even get an honorable mention. He doesn't even get a mention. Nobody even says, and I want to thank the Lord for giving me my very life breath, giving me my energy, giving me my talent, giving me the ability to perfect the talent, giving me the strength, giving me the direction, giving me the arrangement that enabled me to achieve this particular reward. No thanks for God. Well, if I mention God, then he'll get the spotlight. So why should I mention God when I want the spotlight? So let me seem very thankful and appreciative by thanking all those who helped me, rather than thanking the Supreme Lord who put all those wonderfully talented people in your association and enabled the result or the reward to occur. So God doesn't even get an honorable mention. And this is quite unfortunate because the reality is completely lost. And as I said, the reason God doesn't get an honorable mention because it means we would take the focus off ourselves and put it on someone else and give him the credit for all that we think we did. The living entity in this, bewildered by false ego, thinks himself the doer of activities that are in actuality carried out by the three modes of material nature through the Maya. And who controls Maya? Krishna controls Maya. He's the controller of Maya. So, we're thinking that we are the doer, but it is simply the modes of nature which we contact over and over again and which begin to dominate us. It may be the mode of goodness. It may be the mode of passion. It may be the mode of ignorance. Whatever we contact regularly, that's the way our minds will function. That's the way our tastes will desire. So it becomes important to understand for all of us that we're in a race. The living entity is stuck in this body. And there's the cruel death, or they call him the grim reaper, you know, with the big black cloak and the hood, and he's got that scythe that's big like a sword, and he's behind us, and he's getting closer and closer. And as you look back, you see he's getting closer. And you look in the mirror, you see some hair falling out. He's getting closer. Or you see wrinkles occurring in your face. He's getting still closer. Your teeth are starting to fall out. He's getting real close now. So, by knowing that this grim reaper is there and that we're in a somewhat of a race with him, if we achieve God realization before he finally cuts off our head, and no one is exempt from that, well, then it's a glorious day for the devotee. It's a happy day. It's a joyful day because he's going home. He's going back to Godhead. He's going to that place where there is no misery, no uncertainty, no doubt, only pure transcendental bliss, transcendental peace, transcendental strength, transcendental power, transcendental freedom. Everything that the living entity is striving for, trying for in the material world, but never, ever finding it. Because he's looking in the wrong place. It's like if you have your gold buried in a particular hole in the ground, but you look everywhere in the backyard, but that place where it is, well then, you're not going to find the gold. So Srila Prabhupada has so mercifully, so kindly come here to tell us in these most wonderful books where the gold is. He's given us the gold in the book itself. He's told us exactly what we have to do. Accept whatever is favorable for discharging devotional service. Reject whatever is unfavorable for devotional for discharging devotional service. Believe firmly that the Lord will always protect his devotees. Feel dependent always on the mercy of the Lord. Have no separate interests but the interests of Krishna. And always be meek and humble. So these are six principles of surrender that a devotee takes very seriously. So we have this, as I said, this race is going on. But for the person who is beheaded, chopped, and is in complete material consciousness, for this person, death is a very sorry day. Frightened, shocked, uncertain, miserable, cut off from his relatives, cut off from his son, his daughters. We saw Ajamil when he was on his deathbed. He was screaming out for that person who was most dear to him, his son. Narayan, 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 where are you, Narayan? Fortunately, Krishna guided him to name his son Narayan so that at the time of death he would become attached to Narayan, and the result of that attachment would be he would cry out the name Narayan, and in crying it out, all his sinful reactions were completely wiped away. At the time that he was about to be taken, by the Yamadutas, the servants of Yama, to Yama, and then deposited in hell. But because he chanted this holy name, because he cried out, Narayan, his sins were wiped away. And when the Yamadutas attempted to put this noose around his neck and began to yank him the soul and the subtle body out of the physical body, who showed up? The Vishnudutas appeared there. Halt! Stop! You can't take that man. Why not? We have orders from our spiritual master, Yamaraj. He's a sinner. But he chanted the holy name of the Lord, which wiped away, which evaporated all his sins and just sinful reactions in just a moment. So you cannot take him. Oh, we've never heard this philosophy before. Well, you're hearing it today. Well, we'll have to talk to our spiritual master about this. So they were completely befuddled. They were bewildered. They didn't know how to deal with this. And they actually had to ask Yamaraj about this. And Yamaraj gave them very serious, very important instructions and said, anyone who chants the holy name of the Lord at the time of his death, or hears the holy name of the Lord at the time of his death, you leave them alone. They're free of their sinful reactions. And so this was a big eye-opener, a big awakening moment for Ajamil. He knew then, when he heard that argument between the Yamadutas and the Vishnudutas, he knew then that he had wasted so many years of his life. And when he returned to normal consciousness, he realized he had been given a new lease on life. So, did he immediately go looking for his prostitute wife? No. Did he begin to just hug and hold his little child? No. He knew he had very little time left. He was given a reprieve or a new lease on life, which could have been another week or two or months or maybe a year. And he was going to use that in the best possible way, not to waste it anymore. He had been robbing, he had been cheating, lying, swindling, stealing, whatever it took to get money to help satisfy his prostitute wife, if you want to call her that. Actually, his real wife, he deserted her. So he left and he went to Haridwar, right near Rishikesh. And he sat down and chanted the holy name of the Lord ever and ever, over and over. And then finally he became, his sinful reactions had been taken away, but his sinful tendencies had not yet been taken away. He had to do something to achieve that. And what did he do? He chanted. So the desire for sinful activity gradually disappeared. Instead of lust and anger and greed and envy and illusion and madness and sloth and gluttony and all these horrible feelings which make a mockery of the human being, instead of this, he began to feel slowly but surely pure love of God. And he felt the bliss that comes from that. Because when a person chants sincerely, lovingly, surrenderedly, when he chants with his whole heart in full desperation, knowing that he has been given a great blessing, a great benediction, that he could have been dead, when he chants in this fashion, the Lord hears like a child crying out for its mother. If a child just goes, well, the mother, you don't do anything, because there's no desperation there. The child goes, still no desperation there. But when the child, mother comes very, very quickly, picks up the child, hugs the child, tries to figure out what's wrong with the child, feeds the child, or looks at the body of the child to see if there's some inconvenience or something, maybe a pin, diaper pin or something, or maybe the child is wet or something like that, but tries to relieve the child of its misery. This is the nature of mother. And it's the nature of Krishna. Krishna has put that into every woman so that when she has a child, she will feel affection. Even though the child may kick her, child may spit at her, child may pass stool on her dress, mother still loves the child. Similarly, the individual may have committed so many sins, so many offenses, so many wicked activities, but still Krishna loves his child. And when the child cries out desperately, Krishna, 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 hey, when he cries out in that fashion, Krishna hears him. And he relieves him. And he gives him or her his presence. How does he give us his presence? He floods the heart with his love. And that love manifests as transcendental bliss. When Krishna is giving us his love and we feel that bliss, we feel that peace, we feel that strength, then we no longer at that moment are identifying ourselves with the material world. We know that we are souls. We know that Krishna is the supreme soul and that he is looking after us and that we have a connection with him. We are related to him. We belong to him. And everything in this world belongs to Krishna. We know that at that time. And so Krishna is the swift deliverer. He delivers us from the path of birth and death, and takes us over the ocean of miseries and deposits us in the transcendental world, the world of Vaikuntha, and ideally Goloka Vrindavan. This is what Krishna wants for all of us. And we saw in that very wonderful illustration of Ajamil, at a point an airplane arrived, a golden airplane from the spiritual world. And the same persons whom he had seen when he was about to die, those same two servants of Lord Vishnu, Vishnu Dutas, they were there. And they welcomed him to get on the plane, get on board. And he got in and he went back home, back to Godhead. So Krishna is not a cheater to the devotees. To those who don't want him, yes, he will cheat them because they don't want him. They want to appear like him. They want to imagine that they are him. And consequently, he will allow that. He gives us independence. We can choose to be servants of the Lord or to be served like a Lord or as a Lord. And if we choose to be served like a Lord or as a Lord, the result of that is that the more we are, the fire of our false ego or our balloon or blimp is stoked, the more glorification we get, the more adoration we get, the more profit we get, the more beautiful we are, the more wealthy we are, the more strong and influential and powerful we are, the more famous we are. What happens is we begin to think that we're superior to other human beings who are not in that position, who are not in that condition. And when we think we're superior to other human beings, we become proud. I'm better, I'm greater. It doesn't come out in those words. Actually, we're very good diplomats. Everybody you see at the Academy Awards, everybody wants to win it. Everybody hates when somebody else wins it but themselves. But everybody has nice smiles. Oh, I'm so happy. Congratulations. Damn it, I wish I had won it. So they're very good actors. And they play their parts of being loving persons very well. But in their heart of hearts, they're sad. They're sorry. They bought that beautiful dress, that nice tuxedo, and came out to the ball, went to the parties, and they didn't get anything. So the more a person has his false ego, the blimp, blown up bigger and bigger, the more pride he has. The more pride he has, the greater he thinks he is of than other human beings. And when such a time comes that when he is shown or threatened that his great so-called greatness is not really great, that the balloon is slowly beginning to contract, it's beginning to flatten, he becomes frightened and he suddenly realizes that he's not what he was, what he thought he was. And he becomes very frightened, very upset, very disturbed. And he becomes miserable. He was top dog today, tomorrow he becomes little dog. So little dog wants to still be big dog. So how does little dog become big dog? Well, what has he got? If he feels like a small dog, like every human being who has not achieved anything great or glorious or wonderful or fame or any of those things, then he identifies himself with someone who is famous. So he roots for a particular basketball team or football team. Like this weekend, they had the Super Bowl. And so when the New Orleans Saints, they won, all the people of New Orleans were shouting, yay! It's as if their lives improved. How did their lives improve? They didn't get one penny more after the game in their pockets. The Saints did, yeah. They're not really Saints, by the way. It's a misnomer. I won't say what they are. But and in any event, they were not the saints. So they didn't get a penny more. Their job that they don't have didn't suddenly come back. The unemployment situation wasn't relieved. The homes that were still collapsed from the Katrina earthquake, hurricane, the homes, many of them in particular wards, are still lying there completely in a fashion or in a manner that cannot be inhabited. Nothing improved, and yet they're jumping and screaming and yelling as if they won the game. How did you win? What did you win? You don't have anything. You lost $100 on the ticket. That's what you won. A loss of $100. And if you got it from a scalper, you probably lost $500. So they won nothing. They gained nothing. But they thought they won. Why do they think that they have won? Because they're identifying themselves with their bodies. And identifying themselves with the body, since my body is not famous, it's not great, it's not wonderful, it's not doing anything anymore, I'm therefore identifying myself either with the New Orleans Saints, or I'm identifying myself with the L.A. Lakers, or I'm identifying myself with the Los Angeles Dodgers. And when my team wins, I win. When my team loses, I lose. What a horrible way to live. Your happiness is dependent upon others' achievement or non-achievement. This is the emptiness of the soul. When the soul has surrounded itself with all the coverings and trappings of the material world, and it doesn't know itself anymore, thinks itself is the material body, and when the material body is not achieving anything great or wonderful or glorious, then he identifies his own little body with another body and rises with the fame and the name and the glory of that other body, or falls or descends with the loss or the loss of somebody else's body. Not the devotee. The devotee has a whole different situation. First of all, he knows the truth. He knows that he doesn't gain anything. He doesn't gain anything by rooting for any particular team. He roots for Krishna and only Krishna, because Krishna is the supreme person. He's the supreme lover. He's the supreme enjoyer. He's the supreme proprietor. He's the supreme friend of all. Krishna gives us real happiness, not the false happiness of today, false happiness of the moment and then lost the next moment. Krishna gives us, after we have sufficiently centered our intention on the Lord for a period of time and have become completely purified, he gives us transcendental bliss and peace and happiness. And that is always with the devotee. It's like an underground spring. You don't see it above ground, but it's always flowing. And the devotee is always flowing with that joy, with that happiness, with that satisfaction. Sometimes there are waves, and the waves get higher. The bliss gets more intense, and sometimes the waves go down. But the stream is always there. That's what is meant by Krishna consciousness, and all the wonderful symptoms or expressions of it are forever there in different degrees. So it behooves us all to strive harder and harder to try to please the spiritual master, to try to surrender more. As Krishna says, as they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. And Krishna is waiting to reward us with his full blast of pure love. So the more we chant the holy name of the Lord with our whole heart, with full appreciation, in a mood of glorification, in a mood of complete thankfulness that we even got the holy name of the Lord, that we have a chance to not really die as others die in complete ignorance and fear, but instead die to the body anyway, in joyfulness, in happiness, in peacefulness, and go back home, back to Godhead. This is our real destiny. And so every moment we have to realize the Grim Reaper is behind us. So we have to strive harder and harder to try to please Krishna, to love Krishna, to surrender to Krishna, to give our all to Krishna, to serve the devotees, to serve the living entities who are still suffering in the material world, who don't know what the truth is, to share it with them through the distribution of these books, the distribution of the holy name. And by doing such, we transform them, just as Ajamil was transformed as soon as he chanted the name Narayan. By us chanting those names, or giving these books with the name Narayan and Krishna and Govinda, their lives will also be transformed. Immediately the change will start. And gradually, as Krishna says, he takes up He takes up the life of those who are in ignorance, who now have heard the holy name, and brings them slowly but surely to a state of liberation. It may be in this life, it may be the next life, but liberated they will be. So this is our goal, this is our duty, this is our obligation to try our best to become Krishna conscious, more Krishna conscious ourselves, by lovingly trying to serve Krishna, throwing our whole heart into it, and helping others to do the same to the degree that we can. Thank you very much for your attention. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, Prabhu. You got me scared. Your hand went up so fast.
Thank you for the very nice class.
Blasphemy.
In the translation and purport, Prabhupada mentions that there's many people that don't want to be cheated by pseudo yogis or meditators or things of that nature. Mm. So what I was wondering is that in our jobs outside of the temple, or when we're dealing with a lot of non-devotees that mm-hmm. have this type of situation, mm-hmm. like for me, for example, I know many people that come into Govindas and I tell them what I do, and then mm-hmm. they say, oh yeah, I have a guru too, and we don't. And I tell them, we follow the regular principles, chant 60 rounds.
What is that? A little slower and a little louder, please.
I tell them that we follow the four regulative principles mm-hmm. and chant Hare Krishna. Mm-hmm. That's what we do as devotees. Mm-hmm. And they say, oh, we don't have to do any of that. And so how do you, in one sense, not, fry the person out, but, push them away by giving them, straight Krishna consciousness, at the same time not compromising with kind of just letting them believe that, oh yeah, it's okay, everything's one, it's all the same. Because my fear is sometimes, if I tell them directly what it is, then sometimes they may not come back. So
how do you deal with these people?
Yeah, that can also apply to say, if you have a job and you work with people and you're kind of fearful of not telling them directly about Krishna consciousness because you might get in trouble at work. How do we deal with that?
Well, first of all, you have to find out, rather than desiring to just shoot the philosophy out, which many younger devotees like to do, because it kind of makes you feel that you know the philosophy when you can kind of just shoot it out quickly. You first have to listen to them very carefully. You have to listen and try to understand where they're at and what they can handle. That's the first thing. So you need to give them of Krishna consciousness what they could like. And you need to make them your friend. The more you do things for them, the more you show, give them something. People are always responsive to when they are given something. Whether you give them a book, whether you give them praise, whether you give them some understanding, or let them tell you their philosophy. Everything in their philosophy may not be bad. They may be doing certain things we're doing. So what you do is you capitalize on that. You try to find that which is relatable, that which is similar, and you build a friendship on the commonality or the similarity of those things. And then they feel some unity with you. You can't really convince someone. It's very difficult. Unless you're a very, very incredibly powerful preacher like Srila Prabhupada. Very difficult. First thing is develop harmony. Like any book distributor knows, you have to try to, in just a few seconds, develop a sense of friendship with them. Once they feel disarmed, so to speak, feel you disarm them and enable them to feel that you're their friend and you've got something great for them, not that you're going to help them, but you're going to just share something with them. As soon as you say you're going to help them, you're patronizing. But as soon as you say you're sharing something that you got, and you just feel like you're so greedy that you've got to get it out and share it. You see, there are different ways of dealing. So in the situation that you have, first thing is to find common interest in philosophy. The second thing that you do after you've found a common interest is that you've then establish what we call rapport. Once rapport is established, you're slowly opening up the gate to be able to put the real philosophy in. You may not be able to do it the first time. You may not be able to do it after 10 times. The person's heart has to be softened a little bit. And then you can give them what you want, but sometimes you do it in a question. Well, what would you think of this, such and such? No, for example, if you were told to not drink or have intoxication anymore, what do you think about that? Draw them out. Find out. And then gradually, through the process of not dictation, but through questioning and through humor, you can enable a person to realize how foolish, how stupid and ignorant he is, but without making him feel so big, just like a little tiny worm. Rather, he comes to the realization. He says, yeah, that's because you made him, you enabled him to feel large and big and strong. So now he's ready to be knocked down a little bit. But if you start out with a punch to the jugular or a punch to the side of the jaw, you don't stand a chance. He's going to come out and punch you back. That's the way young preachers act. So take it from an old bird, a very old bird, getting closer and closer to 100 years. Take your time. Be patient. Try to be understanding. And try your very best to raise them, strengthen them. This is not cheating. This is psychological warfare. And you are preparing them for the real truth, for the bomb you're going to drop. But the bomb has to have a proper it's got to have a proper foundation for it to explode and do its business. If you throw it in the water, not much is going to happen. You throw it on the concrete, it will happen. Is that, do you understand the point? Yeah. Yes, Prabhu. We're going a little over time, I'm sorry. But this will have to be the last question.
Okay, I just wanted to make a quick comment.
Yes.
Because yesterday, a prime example of just what you were saying, I was on the beach, meditating with the ocean, working on my art, and I noticed another lady was sitting there doing the same, kneeling towards the ocean and sharing with the ocean. And I just felt like some kind of pull, like she was having some kind of emotions or something. Mm-hmm. But then she just got pulled to me and came up to me and just, hey, how are you doing today? And I was just like, well, wonderful. I'm out here, you know, sharing time with the ocean and the spirit. And, you know, we shared a little bit about art. She's also an artist like myself, so we had that in common. And, you know, after talking to her for a little bit, she said someone psychically attacked her on down in Venice Beach. And I said, yeah, there's a lot of darkness and confusion. That's why I'm out here on the beach sharing time with God. And, you know, I just share with her, you know, after we shared the art thing in common, that, you know, I was sending her a little bit of light because she looked like she needed it. So I was sharing my light with her. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I told her a little bit about my story of, you know, just that, you know, we have a wonderful function down here at the New Dwaraka Temple every Sunday. We have really good, you know, sharing with love of God and a Bhagavad Gita class in Prashadam. And we have Bhagavad Gita classes that, you know, since I've been coming to the temple, it's really helped me to stay away from, you know, drinking and drugs and bad company. And I just share with her how it's helped me out and it's brought me closer to love of God. And
wrap it up now.
Yeah. And then I just, you know, basically, you know, gave her a little book of, you know, one of the small books on yoga and a little card. And so it's just kind of what you're saying. That's what I wanted to share about that.
Harmony, you can do a lot of wonderful things. Animosity, you can't do anything. Hare Krishna.